Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
If you were so insincere with you, Jamie, that you couldn't actually make any sound.
So, I'm Richard Nicholas. Hello. With me to chat about films is Abigail Bain.
Hello.
And Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
We are Filmbin and we chat about films. This week's film was picked by me, is the film. Couldn't remember what it was then. It still the car right, I've remembered, and I will say, is the film The African Queen, which is about a drag queen from Africa.
No, it's not. You're lying.
No, it's the 1951, not really a disaster movie, romance thriller, water-based drama. What would you guys define it as a genre?
I don't know. I would say a romantic comedy, I guess.
If you find leeches hilarious.
Well, it has its dark moments.
You know, death and war and like stuff.
Okay.
No, it's let's just call it a drama and move on. Yeah. What are the details? Let me read them out for the first time. No, can one of you do it? I hate reading the details because I can't read. Hence, I watch movies.
All right, then. The African Queen is from 1951. It was directed by John Huston. The original novel was by C.S. Forster. It was adapted to the screen by John Huston and James Aggie. It principally stars Humphrey Bogart as Charlie Allnut and Katharine Hepburn as Rose Sayer.
And it stars the boat as well.
It does. The boat, the African Queen.
Played by a boat. Don't know what its original name was. Sorry, boat. Can't give you the proper credits you deserve.
It's probably dead by now anyway.
Probably more than one boat, no doubt. You're dead. Did the boats die? This is a stupid start. Anyway. I picked the film because it was in... Do you know you can get those movie books, like 501 movies to watch before you die because life's worth living. You should watch all of the films you're supposed to. So I looked through one of them, I think with Abby, and it was one of those ones where you just kind of go, ah, go on. And we rented it, and it was surprisingly entertaining, considering it's about two actors on a boat. I mean, it doesn't sound that enthralling, but Humphrey Bogart's, you know, a screen legend from the 40s and 50s, and people mostly know him from smoking in dark rooms in noir films, and being, like, the most manly man ever, who just makes ladies swoon for some reason, even though he's a bit of a crusty old crab in many regards. Would anyone care to chip in with their thoughts on Humphrey Bogart?
I only know him as a cliche. Like, that's all I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A trilby, a cigarette, and a bunch of cheesy lines from noir films.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a tremendous screen presence in many ways. I mean, I'm not in any way doing down his career. I'm just saying, it wasn't what I was expecting from him.
No, there's a common perception of him. When you say Humphrey Bogart, you think of, like, Casablanca.
Mm.
Or The Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, or any... Yeah, basically those and other ones
so,
he was
like,
in.
This film was actually his first and only Oscar.
Hmm. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Probably The Stubble. The Stubble was... Like, blew people's minds, because Humphrey Bogart is just usually a little stubbly, but at this he's almost got a beard.
I think it's like, this seems like it was his Rooster Cogburn, because like, I forgot, John Wayne, it's like the common, like, perception or joke about John Wayne is in everything he played John Wayne.
Mm.
Yeah. And then in the original version of True Grit, he played Rooster Cogburn, and the character was completely different. Other than being, you know, in a Western, the character was nothing like anyone he'd played before, and he won an Oscar for it. Because suddenly everyone went, oh, wow, where did this come from? And I think it's the same thing happened with Humphrey Bogart in this film.
Yeah.
Like, suddenly he played completely against type, and no one was expecting it.
Yeah, you know... I say, you know, the role did suit him, but then I don't know how else it would have been played because it's the only version I've seen. Because,
well,
you know,
the
how many versions are there?
The character was originally Cockney.
All right, because they call him Canadian in this, even though he's quite clearly American sounding.
I thought it was funny that like they changed him from being Cockney because he couldn't do a Cockney accent. So they made him Canadian, and then he made no effort to disguise the fact that he's American.
Yeah.
There was no need.
I guess it was to say, oh, because he's Canadian, at least he sort of has some allegiance to the British, and therefore will put the British flag on the boat at the end. A sort of patriotic symbolism thing. Ah, whatever. Like, so anyway, Abby, what did you expect coming into this the first time we watched it?
Well, there's a thing about classic old movies where you run the risk of it being all hype.
Overly nostalgic, people get about the pre-60s, really, don't they?
And I won't lie.
People who are into it are really into it.
I won't lie, I was concerned. But then, at the same time, it was one of those ones that gets talked about so much that I figured there must be something good in there for it to be so famous.
Yeah, I actually hadn't heard that much talk about it myself. I think when people mention the title, which is not that often these days, but you kind of go, oh, that sounds familiar. It's probably a book, isn't it? Like, and you know, I don't know that I've heard, like, people always talk about the Maltese Falcon and what was the other one you mentioned? Casablanca a lot. Yeah. Like, but this one, I hadn't heard that much about it before seeing it. What were you expecting coming in, Jamie?
Shamefully, for as much of a film nerd as I am, I know very little about like pre-60s cinema other than like vague stuff. Mm. And I haven't seen enough like films that are legitimately considered classics and trendsetters. Like it wasn't until I was in my late 20s that I watched Citizen Kane for the first time.
Yeah.
And then when I did, I thought, oh wow, that's basically every film that came afterwards. Like it was such a huge influence. And so I have a really unfair perception of old films where they're all kind of like overly theatrical and overwrought, and I always think I'm going to hate them when I watch them, and then I never do when I actually do sit down and watch it. It's like westerns. I had a huge problem with westerns for years until I actually watched some and really enjoyed them. So it's my own sort of ignorant bias that prevents me from like appreciating stuff like this until I actually watch it. And it was the same with this. Like I saw 1951 Humphrey Bogart, and it's just inside I just went, oh. and then I sat and watched it and I enjoyed the whole thing. Like, and I knew deep down I would, but I still had this layer of belligerent teenager, no, the only good films are Kevin Smith films.
No. we're from the Ghostbusters is the best movie of that generation, really.
Yeah.
And I understand. I've seen a few things from, I think the 40s is interesting to me because I quite like thrillers and crime. So I did get into a lot of noir films. I tried a lot of the big famous ones that people haven't actually seen. And, you know, I've seen a few, and then, you know, during the 40s and 50s, you know, things have a different style, a different feel.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, like, we don't go, there's only 100-odd years of proper cinema anyway to experience. So I thought it was good to try something a bit earlier. And 1951, you know, they've practiced and understood how to do films creatively, but still are not in a kind of, in a modern style, and, you know, we're not that much technology available.
My problem a lot of the time with films from this particular era, when like colour started to come in, is that a lot of them, this one's a little bit, is that they, when they were more limited in the 40s and in the 30s, films were like not surreal, but they had to be more imaginative with the way they were framing stuff. Like they had to tell a story a lot more visually. Whereas when colour started to come in and the technology got a little bit more advanced, the idea of realism started to creep in. Mm. And a lot of films that I see from the 50s where colour started is that they've got this sort of try hard, like no, look how real this looks thing going on, which they don't all have, but a lot of them do. The previous films and then subsequent films don't have. It's like this little awkward period, kind of like when CGI like first exploded, really exploded onto the scene in like the later 90s.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, look what we can do now. Let's yeah. absolutely use it to
and
death.
The Matrix came out, so then suddenly everyone started using similar special effects because it was the new thing, and it just...
Yeah.
And I suppose that's one of my the things I would have preferred at this film is if it was a little bit more stagey, like films before it were.
Mm.
You reckon?
Yeah.
What, like you had a... I kind of thought it was very ambitious to try and do
it was. No,
a story of a boat going through an African river. I mean, a lot of the time they've got really dodgy green screen and they have, you know, stock footage of animals either pumped in audially or just clips of, I don't know, nature documentaries to sort of that aren't there with the actors. And occasionally it's a bit clunky, but, you know.
It's hard. Yeah, it's hard to criticize that kind of thing because I get frustrated when people criticize films because they're dated, because that's not fair.
Yeah.
No.
And then I find myself doing it and I'm just being a massive hypocrite because like, that's not a fair criticism at all because this film was made in 1951. You can't pick apart the special effects, you know.
It's like picking up a book and going, oh, there's no pictures. What am I supposed to read between the lines about? What's going on? Like,
But I am always impressed though when I watch a particular film like this that is well made and it's a very lean story. Like it is pretty much just these two characters the whole time. Mm. When you watch a film like that from this era, and then you realize as you watch it, the influence it had, like I said about Citizen Kane, like I watched it when I was like 27 and suddenly I realized I was watching every film I've ever liked rolled up into one, you know, 2 hour picture.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the same thing, not to such an extent, but you can see where other films picked up on certain things and where certain techniques came in. And like, you can see the evolution of cinematic storytelling techniques starting to appear in films like this.
Yeah, it does set a lot of interesting ideas in motion for further films to develop on and improve on. I mean, in many ways, it's kind of a James Cameron style movie.
Yeah.
That, you know, you'll probably be able to look back at James Cameron stuff and go, oh, how terrible is that? Couldn't we do better? And you could do that now, but, you know, actually, you're not going to praise James Cameron backhandedly. I don't think he's a particularly interesting filmmaker. But it just relates to the getting modern technology and really going, right, what can we really do with this? How can we push our technology to the limit? And it really comes up with some interesting ways around the problems of not being able to film everything you want in the world, you know?
It reminded me of Apocalypse Now. Like, it was like a much more pleasant and non-traumatic version of Apocalypse Now.
It was the Mills and Boone of Apocalypse Now, really, wasn't it? So the story then, guys, we should talk about that a bit, rather than umming and ahhing about how we felt about the technical achievements. It has an interesting opener in that, I mean, we initially get Jungle Noise, animals, and it sets the scene as the credits roll. But the first bit I want to talk about is the little chapel scene where a minister and his sister are taking a service of African natives. Like, they got a tribe of Africans in their little church, they're missionaries, and they're all trying to get them to sing a hymn. And it's kind of just this incredible din of terrible noise that doesn't sound like anything, apart from the minister who's trying to do a very British hymn and his sister who's playing the piano.
It's not just a British hymn, it's a Welsh hymn.
What hymn was it?
I felt Cwm Rhondda, I think it's called, Bread of Heaven.
Oh, yeah. Stirs up a lot of passion for us.
Oh, I got so patriotic. I stood up, I had tears in my eyes.
Bread of Heaven. Yeah, no, that's not. Yeah, I mean, but then you've got all the tribes people just sort of trying their best to imitate the sounds.
It did actually kind of remind me of when I had to go to church when I was a kid. That's pretty much what it sounded like when everyone sang a hymn.
Some kind of naked savage squealing.
just horrible cacophony of
droning
people trying to, pretending that they're singing a hymn.
I tend to make like a goldfish when I find myself in a chapel having a hymn book in hand. I just I don't know. It's interesting because it kind of shows how bafflingly weird missionaries were back then. When's this film set? During World War One or World War Two?
1931.
So it's like coming up to the war starting for the second time.
Yeah.
It makes it seem more like a sequel when you say it like that. But like, yeah. So these missionaries in Africa are having an uphill struggle trying to convert the Americans. Trying to convert the Africans to Christian and to Christianness, Christianity. There we go. I just think it was a really weird message to say, because it basically goes, yeah, Christians are deluded, aren't they? What are they doing?
That is a bit weird, actually. That it's.
I thought it was quite a bold opener. Like, it was dark for the era.
Mm.
Especially when what happens next, when the Nazi troops turn up and burn down the village and kidnap all the villagers and smash the reverend in the face. And then he just loses his mind and dies. It surprised me how dark that was.
Yeah, it happens at breakneck speed as well. It's a very economical film because the story really goes by quite quickly. It's literally, we're in a church, we're missionaries, and we've got all these African tribe people who are more concerned about when the post's coming and fighting over a cigar that's been thrown away for some reason. I don't know what they're trying to say about, I don't know, either smoking addiction or African tribes.
I think there's some old school slight Hollywood racism there.
Yeah.
Not necessarily racism, but like, you know.
Different time.
Yeah.
It's kind of...
Racism suggests something a bit more
malicious, but it's not.
Yeah.
I think it's just trying to show, it's kind of just saying, you know, like, Christianity is wrong and stupid. It kind of says that, and it kind of says that African tribes people are very different to our culture, and the British were kind of big-headed and stuff.
The Reverend comes across as sort of decent but misguided, like, but he's so dedicated to what he's trying to do that it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I think missionaries always have a tough time because they go places that are very hard. I mean, it's much easier to convert people who are living comfortable, happy lives because it makes more sense, whereas going to an alien culture and trying to say, you need to do things our way because it's what we believe. It's very, very weird culture, the missionary thing. But it's an odd comment to start with. Abby, do you have any more thoughts on it? You sound like you might have more to say.
Oh, no, it's just along the similar lines that I was impressed with the way that it had an opinion, which I assume is the opinion of the book, about the way that the tribes people were giving lip service to religion, essentially.
Yeah.
And that they didn't really understand what they were doing.
Yeah, that's the impression I got as well. Like, they're just sitting there like, what is this? Like, okay, I guess we'll go. And then, which I imagine is probably very much the case when you've got people from an utterly different culture turn up and, say, okay, now you're going to do things our way. And everyone just goes, what? All right, then.
Yeah, I suppose. Another thing about that first part that I like is the relationship between Catherine Hepburn's character, Rose, and Robert Morley's character, the Reverend Samuel, who is her brother, and how, without a lot of time and without all that much to do, they actually come off as really close, and there's a lot of affection there between them.
Yeah, because they must have, you know, quite the friendship if you'll go with your, you know, brother to Africa to be a missionary because he's not really good enough to be a British priest or something. He seems to say in his dying breath that his old backstory, doesn't he?
He comes across as, like, clearly very, very dedicated to what he's doing. And that makes it really, like, it makes it genuinely sad when what happens with the German troops happens. and his reaction and the fact that it just drives him out of his mind. Like, she finds him digging up the soil in the burnt village and says, you know, she mentions that they're in Africa and he's just Africa. Like, he doesn't even know he's there anymore.
Yeah, he's trying to till the land and worrying that it's August and it'll be too late for a harvest to happen and stuff. It's like, no, Africa is sunny all the time, mate. Don't need to worry about it. Like, it is odd. He seems to just die of shock, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Because this is like as if he's got fever, but it's just, you know, the Germans come and they take all the black people to be force them into being an army, which is very hypocritical. Those horrible Germans, and then who knew the tyrannies of war during that time? But you know, they take all the tribes people away and leave them just with their house on the plot of land.
Yeah. They come and basically take everything from him. His whole mission, they burn the village down, but he's got nothing left at that point.
Hit him with the butt of a gun. Not very nice.
Yeah.
And yeah, he goes mad and ends up dying of shock or whatever. And Audrey Hepburn, Rose. I refer to her as Rose because it's easier than saying her full name as an actress every time.
Catherine Hepburn.
Oh, Audrey Hepburn. Different kettle of fish altogether. Idiot. Right, so anyway, Rose is left to deal with him. And yeah, there's a small time where they're on screen together, but there is an odd brother-sister relationship there. Because they could have easily been husband and wife. But then there wouldn't be the need to have her romantically involved with Charlie later. I mean, it would be kind of weird, like, you know.
I think the idea is she's never been romantically involved with anyone.
Yeah, that's the sense that I got.
Yeah, I think, and that's, you know, but if they had been married and missionaries, that story couldn't have happened.
Yeah, because it would have been, weird. I think it would have been, considering the time it was made, that would have probably been pretty controversial if she got with Charlie just after her husband had died. People would have gone, you know, oh, now we'll have none of this nonsense, and the film would have been banned.
Yeah, I guess because the riskiest thing is moving away from the Victorian sensibility they seem to have and into a more practical survival mode, which allows for, oh my goodness, sex before marriage, which we don't see, but it is implied. Like,
I think they had to have them married by the ship's captain jumping to the end of the film. Like, they had to have them married, otherwise they would have run into trouble with the censors.
Yeah, and it's not like, you know, they could have done it. They couldn't have, well, we fall in love a bit and we can't get married. You know, it kind of, the riskiest thing is that they have premarital sex, but really it's about this idea of, you know, politeness getting in the way of nature, I suppose, isn't it? It's kind of, I don't know, it's one man and one woman's journey. I mean, it's more of a journey for Rosemary because it's her being a kind of naive British missionary having to survive, you know, the invasion of the Germans and then get away. And then through her trials and tribulations on the river, you know, womaning up, learning about life in a more practical way.
What I did like quite early on in the film was her thirst for vengeance.
Yeah.
The fact that her brother had died and she just said, right, we're going to take their ship down. And it's like right in the beginning of the film. And I thought, whoa.
Do you want to just go for a little boat trip first, then build, you know, like, it's as soon as she steps in the boat, it's like, can we build torpedoes with this stuff you've got?
Are you sure you wouldn't rather, you know, go home?
Yeah. There's this weird relationship with naiveness all the way through, actually, that I find kind of entertaining.
Yeah.
Because it's just, there's a British formality to her character. She's, you know, very, very British, very polite, very sophisticated, and he's, you know, a stubbly Popeye character. You know, she's not exactly the olive oil to his Popeye.
But there's a, what I did like about that torpedo thing is she comes across as very kind of stuffy and naive, but there's this viciousness underneath in there somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that her brother's died, so she's instantly, as soon as she's on the boat and she sees the gas tank, she says, yes, kill them all.
Yeah, because there's a bit of a chat once, basically, actually some of the scene we've missed is that's quite amusing. Is there's this kind of awkward tea when Charlie comes with the post and the deliveries and stuff with on his little on the African Queen that the film is named after, this little steamboat. There's basically a scene where they have an awkward, polite tea, and his stomach rumbles. And the British people are trying to ignore it. He's trying to be polite about it. And he's just got this really noisy stomach burbling. It kind of went on in a bit weird direction, I thought. But what did you guys make of that?
I think it was supposed to... The thing is, the thing that the film misses because they changed him from Cockney to Canadian is that it's this comment on the British class system.
Oh, yeah, I see. Yeah, that's probably true.
The fact that he was like a lower class Cockney and he's sitting there and his stomach's rumbling while they're giving him tea and bread and butter and being very polite and well-to-do, you know, you've got that then. Whereas, because he's Canadian, it's a little bit, he's a bit gross. it doesn't quite say what it would have said had he been English as well.
Yeah, I guess there would have been that class divide statement there in the original. Yeah, that's a fair point. It's also a point... It's kind of there to point out the type of person the brother is a bit more and suggest that he's more concerned about back home and is politely annoyed about someone getting advanced in society when he isn't and he's failed as a missionary. Well, he's a missionary when he perhaps would have rather been in England being a bishop. And it's a good opportunity to flesh out the characters. But it is a weird burbly comedy gag that not a gag, as a bit, but a comment about flatulence you can't help.
Again, it's one of those things that... I think it still works. It's still kind of funny, but it was funnier in its era.
Perhaps.
You know, it's another sort of changing of the times, kind of the way humour develops. I don't know. I mean, if this was remade as a comedy now, then depending on who directed it, he would have just soiled himself in the chair. If it was like if the Farrelly brothers maybe had taken over the reins,
perhaps. But to take a handbrake turn in the tradition of the movie, because it really is a fast pace. It's basically there's this scruffy bloke who has a boat who turns up with a post and is of a different world. And he's off now, and he's told you there's a war. He doesn't know much about it, and you guys are shocked that there's a war. And it's all very, what do you mean? Everything's going to be thrown up in turmoil and there's going to be soldiers. I don't know, goodbye. And then he leaves, and no sooner has he stepped onto the boat, the village is being burnt down by the Nazis, presumably.
I did like that. The fact that they said, oh, that's silly, let's pray for Britain. And then the Nazis just come round the corner. Uh-oh.
They could have just been waiting. Oh, we'll let him finish his prayer. Then, ironically, show up and be like, ah, there's no such thing as God. He hates you. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, it sort of tries to say, Christianity is stupid and wrong. Some of the time. I mean, she does pray towards the end of the film, and then a flood comes. God loves a flood. So the rain comes, and he's like, I got this. I'll float your boat to safety. Do you know what I mean? And into the hands of more Nazis. Ha ha! You know, God's weird is what they're saying in this film, I think.
He's got his own personal sense of humour.
Yeah. But it makes a very bold statement of, do you know what? Sometimes Christianity doesn't make a difference to anything. Like, you could be as Christian as you like. To survive, you need to man up. It's essentially the message in a way. Anyway, so handbrake turn. I was trying to do a handbrake turn. Failed. We went down more tangents, more little offshoots of the river, back to the main river. See? It's a metaphor.
Yes, Richard.
Thank you. They basically are on a mission out of Africa.
That's another film again, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But they are. They're on their Apocalypse Now journey the opposite way, away from hell. And out to freedom. And essentially it becomes a film about a middle-class British woman trying to be polite and proper and a regular Joe Canadian with an American accent, trying to get on as best they can. Humphrey Bogart's character is very reasonable, actually. It's not a big juxtaposition of him being horrible. He really tries to be nice as he can, but...
That's actually... that was the direction I thought the film was going to go, that he was going to be really kind of gruff and borderline unlikable. But then he's not. He's very...
He's just fine.
He calls her Miss, and he's very, like... Well, this is the thing. Again, this you can see the Cockney character that he didn't end up playing, because he's practically, like, taking his hat off and wringing it in his hands and going, call Blimey Miss. That's basically the character he's playing, just with an American accent.
And it's sort of... He's as polite as he can be, while still... He can't help any problem of... any class difference there is, he can't help it, because he does work on a river in Africa, and is, you know, he is a man that makes sense in the context, and she is out of context. It's not like he can help
it. There's a lot going on with them on the boat that's just... That was very well done. And I liked his relationship with the boat too, like kicking the engine to get the rust going and make sure that it doesn't explode.
That was the thing. I do have a general fondness for things where engines have a character of their own. So, like, we did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang recently, and that's another one of those ones where...
Well, that is, you know, a big character of its own.
But it reminded me, as bizarre and incredibly nerdy as this is going to make me sound, it reminded me of Han Solo and the Millennium Falcon.
Sure.
Like, that's, you know, it was the same as, like, Leia being on the Falcon with Han and him, like, holding together this falling apart ship as she sort of gradually secretly falls in love with him, even though she shouldn't, because he's a dirty scamp and she's a well-to-do princess. It is the same relationship, and that's what I mean when I was talking about, like, this, how films like this have a subtle but quite major influence later on.
Yeah, it definitely is a lot like that, and I think that's a good way to relate it to people who maybe are more in tune with, you know, it's not like the most modern reference, the Star Wars films, but it's a very mainstream reference, and it's obviously, it's almost a very parallel relationship. But it's that thing of real life where, yeah, you know, cars and computers and everything is sort of, well, it's got its foibles that you're used to, and you know, I used to have to drive with a car with no speedometer working, and you know, the odd, you had to sort of put it into a certain gear at certain times so they didn't, like, cut out. And the same thing with computers and printers, there's always, you get used to them being partly broke, and you kind of don't want them to change after a while, because that's just your relationship with the machine, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so we've got, you know, a man, a woman, a boat floating about. And weirdly, all it takes is a quick explanation of, you know, the map to say what our options are from Charlie. And she's like, stick torpedoes on the front. We're going to ram a German, like, steamboat in the middle of a lake. And he's just like, well, ha ha ha. Very good one. Good one. But the thing is, there's only one man that's ever gone down this river, and he was the map maker in a canoe. And it's kind of you can't really go down it, and that's the only way we can go. And there's rapids and mosquitoes and crocodiles and hippos and more rapids and rocks and reeds to get stuck in. And, you know, it's a terrible idea. And there's a Nazi fort. So that's not happening.
I liked his gentle kind of, haha, don't be silly. Like, but it's like they keep creeping along, and every time she brings it up, he's like, no.
Yeah.
It is weird when you get the tipping point of, oh, well, we're just doing this now, are we? Right.
Well, he gets drunk and says, well, he doesn't say horrible things to her, but he insults her. And Humphrey Bogart, being a man of experience, does a very good drunk. He did say, actually, apparently on location, all he ate was baked beans, canned asparagus, and whiskey.
Oh,
and
that's a very antisocial combination.
And he and the director, John Huston, were the only people who didn't get ill.
Oh, right, nice.
Catherine Hepburn got so ill, she had a bucket off camera.
Ooh.
Oh. I guess it helps for the role, though, because it's such a traumatic experience for them. She does look a bit ill sometimes. But it is interesting how she basically... The way she gets him to do what she wants is... She's got such an outlandish, like, plan of, oh, Drew, you got enough ingredients here to make torpedoes. And he's like, well, sort of. I mean, on a technicality, but not really. I mean, you're asking me to do a lot, and that's ridiculous. Yeah. And I was just thinking if we'd put our feet up in the shade through the wall, like in this in this first bit of the river. So he kind of just goes, I think his what, you know, what we see unfolds is he goes, oh, yeah, I'll go along with this for a bit, but I'll show her the rapids. And she'll be like,
you knew.
Let's not. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
She'll pull up a skirt and make Abby's noise there. And, yeah, I'll get my way and we'll be camping out the war.
You didn't factor in the fact that she's actually mental.
Yeah, and how it gets strange kicks out of doing the rapids. And he's like, yeah, I love me some rapids. I've never lived. You know, I love her comparison. It's like, oh, you know, I've never lived so much, like, apart from the odd time when one of my brother's sermons was particularly rip-roaring. Like, and when he gets going, it's like, yes, I feel awesome. And it's like her life and death experience of the rapids is the same kind of enjoyment.
I like the look on his face when she says that, because he was fully expecting her to, like, balk at it and turn around and be like, no, let's give up. And when she gets excited, he just gets this look of, oh, no.
That's
no.
not it's how that like, was supposed to go.
Yeah.
I think the noise is, oh, this has backfired on me. She's actually more keen than she ever was. Yeah. It's odd, actually. She's very, I'm going to kill those Nazis, as you mentioned, Jimmy. Yeah. It's just like, that's it. I'm going to help the British Army by exploding a massive military boat and get my brother's revenge that way, you know. Very odd. And she's very, like, even when they sort of start to bond and become friends and then later romantically involved, at every point they have a problem. There's a look on her face like, so, fix it, will you? Will you sort the problem out? Oh, we're stuck. Oh, the thing's broke. Oh, the boat is absolutely broken after we went down a waterfall. So, fixing the boat then. How could we go about that? Well, it would be impossible and really hard, and we could do it on the docks maybe if we were, you know, not stranded here. Yeah, but welding's not so hard, is it?
Yeah.
No, I suppose I could if... I suppose not, but there is the other part that's broken, the rotor, the blades thing, that's not happening. Yeah, but you could fix it if you went to a lot of trouble, couldn't you? It's kind of odd, isn't it?
To be fair to her, she dives in under there and helps him as well.
Yeah, she's game to help, but every problem they have, there's a look in her eye of, so how do we get over this? What's the next thing we solve to keep going down the river to bomb those Nazis? Isn't it really? But it's kind of odd, even when they start to get romantically involved, he likes her and is happy to do it, but there's a bit of, well, accept defeat, for goodness sake.
She's a hard woman. She throws away all his gin.
That was so mean.
If you're gonna die in Africa, you want to be drunk for the last few hours, don't you?
The thing is, though, that gin could have come in handy if they'd got like injured or something. You know, that's almost pure alcohol that you could pour on a wound.
Yeah, maybe. Abby, what did you make of the bit? Like, there's this marvelous bit where he pours himself a river and gin cocktail and has the gin bottle out in her face. And then the music kicks up and there's this kind of Victorian shock on her face, but also a kind of, maybe she's a recurring alcoholic who's got problems.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Like, is she just scared? Like, is she so naive that she's scared of alcohol because she's never experienced it? Or is she an ex-alky who had a really like rough, like she used to beat up sailors on the docks or something?
She's got a past, is how I read it. But I think it's meant to be. She knows it's the demon drink. What did you think, Abby? I mean, how did you react to the ridiculous melodrama on her face, actually?
Well, there were one or two moments of ridiculous melodrama. And it was one of those things where, because this is based on a book, presumably they at least explain it away in the book in terms of, is it just she is profoundly religious and as an extension of that, she hates drink. Was her father a drunk? What, something like that. But in this, it's just it brings out this sort of not fury exactly, but a distinct sense of.
Well, there's a general sense occasionally of melodrama from Hepburn because she just pulls a really weird face for ages. Like throughout, there's like just moments where she kind of does a whole lot of facial acting that's a bit, yeah, she's, all right, calm down.
She's very, I mean, you know, it seems like a ridiculously redundant thing to say, but she's very old school in her, like, acting style.
If it's it was a theatre, she's acting to the back of the room very much so.
Yeah.
And it looks a bit odd in a film now, but back then maybe it was more.
Yeah, I think normal. I think that's just our, you know, cynical post Generation X bias.
Yeah, perhaps so.
I want all my actors looking at the floor and barely enunciating and mumbling.
But then, in contrast to her, I think Bogart does a much more. He's a much more naturalistic performer.
Yeah.
And, like, you can pick up little subtle things. Like, occasionally when he's apologising and is a bit, like, he feels a bit scolded, there's a sense that when he's apologising, he kind of thinks he's the one who isn't in the wrong. He's kind of, well, I'm being reasonable and nice and normal as far as I'm concerned. You're being absolutely, you know, insufferable as a person. And there's a sense of, I'm apologising, but I'm quite annoyed at you for treating me this way. And there's a lot more subtlety to his reactions. I think it is there if you look for it, especially there's a few like moments where he says things and you can kind of get a sense of both how he feels and how he's saying it, you know?
I can definitely see why he got the Oscar he got for this, especially considering how typecast he was at this point.
Mm. Yeah. He's a very easy person to do a sort of impression of because he kind of is known for a few certain roles and a way of speaking and an attitude, I suppose.
So this was like completely against type. It wasn't just against type, but it was also very good. Like he does a very
good
job.
Thing. Before, one of the things actually I should have mentioned as an expectation when I came in is that I don't particularly care for Humphrey Bogart, but in this, I think he's really, really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Cause he kind of, you know, it's a role where he's as nice as he can be. And usually Humphrey Bogart's begrudging and kind of like grumpy or cynical in some ways in his films. And in this, he's trying to be as nice as possible. And his only problem is this person's strange expectations for what's normal and polite. Right. You know, I mean, they're both interesting performances. None of them bad. I just wanted to flag up Audrey Hepburn's reaction to certain things was a bit weird.
They do have two very different acting styles. Like his in this film is creeping into like a more modern naturalistic style, whereas hers is more kind of old fashioned theatre. And I think that helps the film, showing the difference between the two characters, like her being very kind of restrained and stuffy, so that when emotion does break through in her, it's very full on because she's not very good at, like, she controls it so much that she doesn't know how to cope with it when it comes out. Whereas with him, it's all very on the sleeve and it all just flops out of his mouth. Like,
yeah. I think they're both, you know, both very good. I also think it's a well-developed relationship on the screen. Like, I think story-wise, it's a very nicely and slow, like, even though they go through all these trials and tribulations, they do slowly build their relationship into something we care about as an audience and believe them going from, you know, being from different worlds to being I guess the pivotal moment is when they get into their first spot of proper trouble. They have to go past the fort that's controlled by the Germans.
Yeah.
And they get shot at, but they make it through. And what was another great bit was all the, you know, Africans who were being forced to be in the army were kind of enjoying shooting at the boat and using the guns and not really, like, just having fun trying to shoot it.
That was actually, I really liked that scene where they have to, like, sail past that fort. I just thought that was really well done. I thought the tension was legitimate, like, it was properly tense.
Considering she's going in very cockily, thinking, oh, it'll be fine. And then the reality kind of hits once they're being shot at.
Yeah, and I like the tube being shot off the engine that he has to bind back on while he's being aimed at. And I like that she's right. She says before about the time of day and how the sun will be in their eyes, and he kind of brushes it off. And then when the guy with the rifle is aiming at him, that's exactly what happens. The sun gets in his eyes and he can't make the shot.
Yeah. it is a really well done piece of thrill, I guess is the word. It's a very thrilling and intense moment. And it leads to the pivot I was talking about, where the rejoicing of getting out of that alive. And it's the first time they kind of show their emotions fully and they're jumping for joy and hugging each other. And then Charlie throws her hat in the river. You don't need the hat now. I mean, it looks silly, but it does have a purpose, Charlie. You could maybe swing back around, pick up that hat. I mean, you are in Africa and you're both Caucasian. So anyway, hat flung aside. They have a kiss and then a moment of, maybe I overstepped the mark. This is awkward. Our passion got the better of us. Ooh. shall we have another cup of tea? Because that's awfully British.
That was one of the other problems, I think, though, that in making him Canadian instead of Cockney, is he did constantly make cups of tea.
That's how British people get over the cup of tea. And with an American, it's like, well, I guess you have the tea and it's, you know, to serve it, but why would you be so fond of tea?
He couldn't do a Cockney accent, so it's like, I was impressed by the development of that relationship from that point, because it actually did what I didn't expect it to do, because the cliche here would be, because of who she is to have them kiss and then her get very frosty with him, and the drama would come from the fact that, you know, oh, there's clearly feelings here and you won't admit it, and there's a whole back and forth. But instead, she just embraces it. She does it very slowly, but she just lets herself fall in love with him, and then they share that bond for the rest of the story. And that was, I thought that was good, because it was different. It wasn't what I was expecting, especially from an older film.
Yeah.
I thought it would all be about, oh, I shouldn't do this. And, this can't happen. And he's trying the whole time. But instead she just, it takes her a minute, but she does. Like the moment is when he puts his hand on her shoulder and then she puts her hand on his. And I thought, oh, that's okay. That's a surprise.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but yeah, they could very easily have had it more repressed, but instead,
I think that would have ended up being more tedious.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, it has to go its Mills and Boone route without giving us too much sauciness as well. She has to kind of swoon and fall for this rugged man that saved her. But I think what's key to making it a likable, less soppy romance is the fact that she's such a, you know, she kind of, as soon as she's on the river, she's proactively trying to learn how to do things that are a man's vocation, really, but they're in a desperate situation. And she wants to learn how to steer the boat. She's getting more confident about navigating the river and is proactively helping him, not just, ooh, I'm a lady, I can't. She's not a frosty, polite British woman once they get going, because she accepts her circumstances.
It is kind of ahead of its time in that sense that she's the one with, you know, the guts and the gumption and wants to keep going forward, and he's rugged to a degree, but he's not overtly manly. He's not like, you know, Sean Connery, James Bond slapping her in the face.
Oh, that might be my favorite description of all time.
No, he does.
That's a real man choking a woman with her bikini top.
Well, he's kind of the normal, practical one, but he's not a fool, and she is somewhat foolhardy, but also she hasn't got anything left. She's lost her brother. She's stranded in this situation, and she's like, well, tell you what, I'm taking charge. I'm, you know, going full Wrigley on this situation.
Wrigley?
It's just...
Yeah, from Alien. Ripley.
Ripley. Wrigley.
She's going full Ripley, is what I was saying.
You just ruined the Alien film for me.
Well, it's Ripley, believe it or not.
Oh.
That was awful, I'm sorry. Back to an African queen in Africa, whatever this film was called. The African Queen.
He's such an interesting character because he's, you know, he is a man, but he's kind of soft. Like, he falls for her very quickly. And he wants to turn back. And he's very openly emotional. he doesn't hide it under like a veneer of cold manliness, like you would expect from Humphrey Bogart's, you know, noir characters.
Oh yeah, definitely.
He comes across as very kind of sensitive, and he's got a big heart. And
well, part of the way that she gets him to do what she wants, which is go on a suicide mission down the river, is to give him the silent treatment, and he tries to chat to her for ages, fails in every avenue, and because she won't talk to him, he basically goes, "Oh, I apologize, and I'm sorry if I got drunk one time. Why did you throw away all the gin?" It's like, no, no, it's because you won't drive down the boat like you said you would. Are you kidding? That's suicide and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, I'm just going to keep reading my Bible. And it's like, fine. We'll go and I'll die because I can't be in this boat not talking to you. Which is, you know, a little weird, but I can relate to that.
I'm going... For my own good, I should politely decline from discussing that.
There probably has been situations where Abby won't talk to me and I would happily end my life on a suicide mission than just be stonewalled. Because you don't know what they're thinking and why. It's terrible when ladies do that to you, I can say firsthand. But yeah, anyway, they're on the suicide mission. They've survived the Nazis. They've fallen in love. She succumbs to him and says, do you know what? It doesn't matter about Christianity and being married before anything. And tastefully, everything happens off screen. I think it would have been weird if we'd have seen a sort of romance scene unfold more than just a shoulder and a kiss. A short hand on the shoulder and a kiss, you know, is enough, really.
There's no... I mean, I know they did it to, again, the sensibilities of the time wouldn't allow them to show anything more. But I like that leaves you the option of thinking maybe they didn't actually go that far. They just kissed and thought, right, we'll save this. You know, I know that's a lot of rubbish and they probably went at it like rabbits in the boat. But like, it gives room for like people of different ethical beliefs to enjoy it their own way.
Well, it's implied. And we're left, we could either paint it as some kind of, you know, animalistic ridiculousness or a tasteful lovemaking or nothing at all. You know, but what I liked about it is there wasn't a long awkward moment after. As soon as he woke up, she was nice to him and they kind of went, do you know what? We've been a bit naughty. We should learn each other's first names over a cup of tea and breakfast. And then on... I like that she kind of, you know, she called him dear and it was like, okay, we need to be intimate speaking to each other now because it's going to be weird if we keep up our surnames and politeness after that. And I like that they just go, yeah, let's be mature. Let's learn each other's first names. And from now on, we will hug each other and be romantically involved as if we are newlyweds.
I think that was what worked about it, though, was because it doesn't go, because the story doesn't go that way of her getting more frosty and saying, no, we can't do this, because they just give in and go, yeah, fine, let's just be together. Because of how likable they've been up to that point, you want that to happen, and then it does, and you get completely invested in the rest of the story.
Yeah, because now, they're just... to see a couple take on disaster together as a unit.
And they're so believable as a couple as well that they just make this great team and you want to see them succeed.
If anything, Humphrey Bogart makes it a little more schmaltzy at certain times where it's just they survive something or there's a certain moment and he's got his arm round and he's professing his love and it's like, yeah, all right, you're still surviving out in Africa on the river. Back to business, is it? You know. Abby, how did you feel about it? I mean, it's a movie to empower women in many ways. I mean, did you like the romance? Did you feel for this character?
What I liked about their romance in particular is that you know it wasn't based on looks.
Although, as part of an apology, he does shave off his kind of massive stubble, almost beard. And there's a kind of passive-aggressive talk of how she's you've helped because having a woman here makes me get up early and do all those things. He kind of begrudgingly takes in his stride all the things that she must have implied he should do. And I did like that he shaved in a way to make himself look more respectable and tidy. Although he did get the stubble back within the same scene he shaved. Sorry, Abby, well, you were saying. Sorry, Abby.
Well, what I was going to say is, not to say that Bogart or Hepburn are not attractive people, but they are not cast for being attractive, if that makes any sense.
I think what was impressive about this is that they didn't look like movie stars.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
At any point in the film. And the more the film went on, the more tired and beaten up they looked.
Yeah, which... and in the 50s, everyone looked like a movie star in a movie. Well, they never looked real. They always looked like a Hollywood interpretation of reality.
You still, even now in like 2014, you still see a lot of films where even when people have been through hell, they still look reasonably well made up. It's like the cliche of like people waking up in the morning and they look amazing, and that is not what happens. And
speak for yourself. You may have tremendously terrible bed hair and look like Homer Simpson, but I wake up and I look like an Adonis. So,
but no, they look like they've been through hell. They look tired and old, and not. I don't mean that in a bad way. They just look like they've been alive for a while. They don't look. They're not. I think in the book they're in their 30s, and that does make it a little bit more Mills and Boone. Whereas because they look older and they look like they have character in this, it makes that relationship that much more believable.
And it's a much more unique film for that, I think.
Yeah, and it gives them a lot of depth. It makes them look like they've lived their own lives and now they've found each other.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. One of the other things we get as part of the trials and tribulations is it's very quickly intercut with light moments, like, you know, whether it's cups of tea or hippopotamus impressions, which was like, it was a great bit before they go off a waterfall or something where Humphrey Bogart's jumping about like an ape and making a weird hippo noise. And she is loving it. She thinks it's the funniest thing ever.
I thought, actually, I couldn't tell in that scene whether that was actually footage of her genuinely laughing, because she snorts like 3 times.
Does she is crippled with that.
Yeah.
It's a very coupley moment, actually, when two people are together and one makes the other one laugh, and it's just, we've just gone, it's hilarious.
I know. And
it's not even that funny, but now it's just in the moment.
And making her laugh not by cracking a joke, but by making an absolute fool of himself.
Yeah. And it takes away all that suave respect he has as an actor from all of his previous roles, where he's too cool for school. He's kind of a goofball.
Yeah.
And it is kind of funny to see him prattling about. But we have every moment of happiness is instantly, and back to the problems. This time it's horrible gnats, you know.
Oh, the mosquitoes, yeah.
And what else? We have gnats, we have rapids, we have a waterfall. And then probably the moment where they go through the most hell is at the end where they're stuck in reeds and mud. And they actually have to get out of the boat and pull it along. And there's leeches and they're just torn to shreds and stinking.
That was actually, because the film had kind of absorbed me at that point, I honestly didn't know whether they would both survive.
You kind of expect, you know what, this is going to be a tragedy at the end, isn't it? They finally get three and then one of them will die of tuberculosis or something. or just be killed by someone they try to save or something.
Again, another sort of strength of his performance is when she's like wrapping him up in sheets after he's dragged them through the swamp and been covered in leeches. Is he's lying there and he's like shivering and he looks ill. He looks genuinely ill.
Proper ill.
Yeah. Which is ironic because Katharine Hepburn probably was that ill while they were filming it.
And then she does her prayer and actually pray to be well for the rest of the film because it's going so horribly for her. Yeah. I mean, there's loads of bits. And there's even, I think there's a key moment to their romance where they're just sort of happy and contented. They kind of mention the flowers that may not have a name and they're going, it doesn't matter, they're beautiful, blah, blah, blah. It gets very romantic when they're kind of attached to the river and the location. Yeah. And because their romance has happened to you, they're attached to this trial they went through in many ways. So there's a kind of, they have still got an affection for that part of Africa, even though it's a massive struggle all the way to the big lake they're heading for.
it is very much the opposite Apocalypse Now. Whereas, you know, they're going out of the river towards the sea and gaining their humanity rather than going up the river into hell and losing their humanity.
Yeah. It is. It's oddly, I hadn't seen that comparison, and there's a lot of interesting things. Like, it is a little bit Star Wars and a little bit Apocalypse Now, and along with being a Mills and Boone classic.
It also made me think of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. You know, the one with the awful woman in it, Willie Scott, who screams the whole time. But it's that kind of thing of the rugged man and the proper lady bonding. Kind of. Except this is done much better than Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Yeah, you can like the characters and enjoy it.
Yeah.
I guess we should get to the sort of climax of the film, which is they are saved by God, possibly, who finally shows up after like ruining their life for so long. And it rains. They get, you know, washed out, and they enjoy being out in the proper lake. And then, of course, they're enjoying themselves. More tragedy. Here's the big steamboat full of Nazis. They have to paddle themselves back to the reeds, and they come up with the plan of, do you know what? We're going to do this now. We're going to actually make the stupid torpedoes. It's still ridiculous to say. We're going to make the torpedoes out of the, what is it, like exploding jelly, gelatin, what's it called?
Yeah, he's got some kind of explosive gelatin. It's gas cylinders, and then he made like a detonator.
Off screen, just to save us any worries. I mean, this is after he's hammered the boat back into shape with like bellows that he had to create. I mean, they've gone through a lot of trouble where we've luckily cut past a lot of it. We could have, well, this is them getting over it. Let's not spend too much of them underwater, or, you know, they spend a little time showing us, but we don't bore ourselves to death with them surviving.
Yeah.
So, you know, they cut to the chase and they go, right, we've made these. We're going to.
I think it's in that like old fashioned Hollywood sense, people worry too much now in films about like tactical realism. Like, yeah. they question bizarre things, like
as we are in many ways.
Well, no, like in this, the film brushes past the whole thing about fixing the boat underwater. Like, it shows it a little bit and then it skips ahead, or it doesn't show him physically making the torpedoes, because what's important to this film is their relationship. That's the focus. And yeah, the film expects you to just go, oh yeah, they fixed it, or that, yeah, he made the torpedoes, whatever, fine. Whereas like now, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a recent example. It's the Dark Knight, the one with Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
Where like people would watch it, and then you go on the internet and you read, and people complain about how like the Joker's unrealistic. Like, how did he know things were going to happen? How did his plan
also
work?
Or how did the technology work? I mean, they show us a lot in, say, Dark Knight, how he shipped all the stuff, how he did it to make like, it look. They tell us it's not even suspicious, and then people go, well, the mobile phone network couldn't do that thing. That doesn't make sense. It's like, oh, well, yeah, it is a science fiction guy. So,
or like, yeah, the other example of that weird hang-up people have about that kind of realism is Javier Bardem, the villain in the last James Bond movie, Skyfall, where he, like, people questioned the fact that he could second-guess and he had this immense plan and he could be everywhere at once. The point is, and this film understands it because it's an old film and there was no internet for people to be fussy and stupid. Mm. It doesn't matter. What matters is the story. As long as it makes sense in itself, it's not a big deal. And this film does exactly that. It's not important how he makes the torpedoes. It doesn't matter. What matters is their relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I like pedantry. Love it. Love pitching things apart. That's why we do a podcast about films. But all that said, you got to suspend your disbelief because you're essentially watching like recorded sound and many photographs sped up of human beings. You're not. It's not reality. You don't have to worry about all the little things making sense. It's an illusion for your entertainment. Be entertained, and let's not worry about every little detail. Please save us the time of showing us their journey in real time, you know?
Yeah. If it was completely realistic, we would be watching this film for weeks.
And we would probably have ended at the point where we had, like, sweat patches under our arms from sitting there going, oh, this is the first 2 hours of the boat trip were too much for me. All it was awkward silence and awkward chit-chat. And it stinks of gin and Africa. And apparently some horrible flowers which were on the river that smell a bit weird. But, you know, they try and torpedo the big boat. And what's nice is they just sort of fail because it sinks, because they've cut holes in it.
I really like the fact that they didn't manage it. I don't, like, not in a... It wasn't funny. It was just kind of... I'm going to contradict myself now. It was kind of realistic.
Yeah, we've gone we've made bombs overnight or over... Well, it actually took a few days to make the bombs to, oh, we tried, it failed, as would you'd expect. I completely agree. And also... One of the things that's nice is we don't really see an exciting crash where they fall into the water. We just sort of edit our way around it to imply that they've fallen in and now they're in the water. The other scene I liked, actually, I just wanted to mention it because we didn't mention it. When they go off the waterfall, we have a few further away shots of essentially a model boat going down like in some kind of water set. And it's just like, oh, it's so sweet. Look, it's meant to be them. And it's just a little boat on in someone's bathtub or something.
It was a little bit Thunderbirds.
It was really quite good considering the time period.
Yeah, no, it was impressive for 1951. That was a pretty decent special effect.
You know... And again, if you're bought into the characters, you almost don't notice the old-fashioned way of doing things where there's no other way to film this. Yeah. They were very creative in, you know, using the right edit to sort of go, I think I get what has just happened there. Yeah, sure, they fell in, right, now they're in the water, let's carry on, you know, innit, you know?
They also, in this scene, the Nazi with the spectacular moustache.
Oh, yeah.
I love a moustache. It's like a film bit drop.
But he does... Like, he was clearly not a German actor because he mispronounces Kaiser Wilhelm.
Okay.
One of them says it right, and he calls him Kaiser William.
What do they call Kenya as well? They have a different take on how Kenya is pronounced.
Kenya.
I'm not going to worry if it's right or wrong. I think one that pricked up my ears.
I think that's an American pronunciation, I think.
It matters very little, but there were the odd, that's a weird take on that word or pronunciation, as you say. But then we got a, you know, American Canadian Cockney, so let's not worry about it. The Nazis are kind of interesting, and they have their little pointless court where essentially Charlie looks away, and then Rose has disappeared and has been washed away elsewhere for now. So he thinks she might be dead, so he doesn't even care if he's going to be executed when they have him on board.
When they do bring her on board and they're together in front of the Germans, I like their little interplay of her being like, no, let's just tell him everything. You know, like at that point they're getting executed anyway. And then he explains how he made the torpedoes and he really enjoys himself.
Yeah, because he's just like, whatever. And then when she's rescued as well and brought on, she's, you know, telling them how it is, and he does join in. He's like, yeah, actually, we were pretty good, weren't we? And they do, and then, of course, their story's unbelievable. What? You don't believe this story? And I'm with the Germans. It made no sense. And it is a nice moment where they kind of go, oh, whatever, let's just... They kind of talk German and go, we're just hanging you. This court, apparently, has decided we're hanging you for being spies or something. We don't really care. We haven't got time for this. We got a schedule of German efficiency to keep to.
They do seem very put out by having them on the boat. They just want to hang them and get them out of the way.
They are the enemy if they're British, which they sort of are. So, you know, who's got time for a man who says he was fishing and a woman who says they were blowing them up and blah, whatever. Let's hang them and be done with it. And that's kind of... Well, that's all we get, really, is there's a hanging... And a brief wedding, because, you know, Borgard's like, well, you got to marry us because you're a captain and you can. And I know it doesn't matter that it won't count in any way. But when we get to the gates of heaven and we're like, how's it going, God? You can be like, well, I know I messed you about a bit, but in you come. You did get married in the end.
I like that you see their boat still bobbing around in the water. Like, it sets it up nice and clearly what's about to happen.
Yeah, they do foreshadow the accident that saves them from the noose in the fact that the African Queen's last-ditch attempt to do some good is to bob up and down with its homemade torpedoes.
Yeah, I like that the boat does it.
Yeah, the boat saves them, because it's the African Queen. It knows it's the hero here.
Yeah.
It's the thing that dies to save people. And, you know, it's there's a lot that happens on that boat that we haven't talked about, like them getting over her kind of British politeness when it's raining, and he's like, well, I don't want to be rained on. Can I just come in? I'm sorry for coming in. I didn't mean to come in. Don't get cross with me. I'll sit cold and die in the rain. It's fine. And then she's like, you can come in. I'll even give you my umbrella and you can lie on that stupid picnic basket there. We must love each other.
When the Nazi boat hits the African Queen and sinks, I don't know if anyone else noticed, one of the crew throws a live cat.
Yes, I did. I thought I saw that. They were like ropes or something, and then one chucks a live cat.
It's a real cat. You can see it, like, kicking as it flies through the air.
I did not see that.
Yeah. And it's
odd.
Like, what happened to make that come about?
There's another story about an African guy who was taken from his village, forced to be in the army, and has a cat that he loves and is trying to save.
Where was the cat on set? Had it just wandered in and they were like, hey, there's a good prop right there. And they just threw it over the edge of the boat.
Well, Abby, I know you will be pleased because you're a big advocate for not killing dogs in films, which happens in every film with a dog. That dog dies, pretty much. Like, you can almost guarantee it. And I know that you'd rather see a few cats imperiled, right, Abby?
It's not that I'd rather see cats imperiled. I mean, ideally, no animals would be imperiled at all. But I do think there should be a level of fairness in cinema. Yes.
it's such a sign of the times that they were allowed to just chuck a live cat on camera.
And for such a throwaway moment that some of us didn't spot properly.
It means nothing, and it's a split second, but it's right there.
It's good as well, because it means that some of the Africans are being saved, essentially, because they can swim back to shore, potentially.
Yeah.
What I liked, the last bit in the water with the boat sinking, was one of the, you see the Germans in the sea going, what the heck happened? And then the guy tries to salute even though he's trying not to drown. Like, it's just like, nice.
German efficiency.
Yeah, that's good. And then essentially, our newly married couple get to swim to their death in the middle of the jungle. And are happily singing the song that I think was sung when Jin was involved.
Yeah.
A sea shanty, yes, because all sailors like singing is the thing. Yeah, and we kind of, it's weird as well, because that's so clearly a sound stage. There's such an echo.
I know.
It's so like, why are we carefully not showing any of the background other than sky, guys? And why do you all sound like you're in a room? Oh, it's because you are in a room in London. Yeah, I totally forgot.
It does do that great thing that a lot of, like, pre-60s or maybe even 70s films do, where it just ends. Okay, story's over, the end, leave.
I do miss that, actually. It's a nice kind of... It's the thing with end credit. What do you call those things at the ends of movies now? After credit, something or others?
Oh, just the little like bonus scene at the end. The post-credits.
It better be good if you're staying that long for an extra nugget at the end of a film. I do miss the days where it's just like, oh, I can go now.
Also, we got the credits over at the start. You know, you sat there rummaging in your popcorn and like moving in your seat and chatting or whatever, or doing whatever while the credits roll and music, whatever, who cares? You got them done. So it's like, end, time to get up and talk about the film, you know, like straight away. And, I think I do kind of miss that a little bit. Modern films do like to drag it on. They'll even have a reprieve. Like, they'll have it where the graphics come up. It's like, here's all the actors that were in it, but with a cool graphic and music. And we've paid for the licensed music now of this artist, especially for this film. So we're going to make you listen to all of Chemical Romance because, you know, they were the theme, apparently, of the film. You know, it's kind of like, we can just get up now. No one really wants to see the credits, so stick them at the start. I'm all for the credits. Credits are important, but when a film ends, it ends, and you're done. And that's good that this does. And we've come to our end, but we do have to do our final thoughts and our little rating system. Unless there's any other bit of the film you want to go, another bit that I thought was worth mentioning, another cat thrown about or an African tribesman doing something suspect. If there's anything else, now's the time, guys.
Ooh.
I
don't think so, no. That was just an ooh of thought.
Oh, no. I did think... I'm assuming the version we all watched was the restoration from, like, 2009.
Yes.
It looked really nice. Like, it was just a very colourful... bold-looking film.
We got all the tick boxes of a movie set in Africa. We got elephants, we got giraffes, we got lions. You know, we got all the stuff you want from an African safari thrown in possibly just, you know, we got some nature footage to cut in. But it did look good. Even the times where it's hokey green screen, even in times where you're like, well, you forgot to film that scene, why are you green screening a bit where you had a set a minute ago? What's going on? Like, there's a bit at the start, it's like, why did you green screen in the garden at the start? I mean, surely that was something you could walk over and film at. Whatever, film. Whatever. Okay. There's loads of bits where you go, bit suspect, but it still looks good, as you were saying. Sorry.
Yeah.
So, rating it.
My first instinct is to say boats, but I also don't know any boats at the same time.
We could tie it into Apocalypse Now and say it's the same Apocalypse Now boat story in reverse. We've already said that, so in many ways it is Mills and Boone, Apocalypse Now, the opposite down the river. You know, that is what you get. You get romance, you get thrills, you get people going through hell, you get a kind of people learning to be stronger characters and learn about life a bit more, and, you know, empowerment and romance. It's got everything, and I've forgot to criticise things. We've criticised a little, a hint of criticism. It's very hard to find problems.
Any criticisms I have are more to do with the fact that I'm used to more modern film techniques. Like,
yeah,
you know, I found the score kind of intrusive. But I find the score intrusive on most films from this era, just because that was the style. Like,
plus,
a modern
movie will sometimes have a bit of a blatant score that
more
subtly pulls your heartstrings, but it's still there, kind of making it more cliched, really.
Yeah, but it's not... It doesn't feel like a valid criticism, because that's another one of... You have to see it in the context of its time. And I think in the context of its time... This was really good, and it was really unique. It did a lot of new things. It had a very different performance from Humphrey Bogart that was very good. I know it's really hard to find any real faults with it.
It is. It is, in many ways, the most modern, up-to-date kind of speedboat you can get in the 50s.
And it's not even... Because this is going to sound awful, but a Hollywood film made in the 50s set in Africa, I was expecting some racism.
It's there a smidgen if you want to pull it up on it, you can, but really it treats it fairly.
Yeah, there's no kind of malicious overt racism in it.
It's a very liberal film, especially in regard to its interpretation of how Christianity is perceived and how
and the
old
the
values empowerment... are treated.
The empowerment of the female character in it. I mean, there's some, you know, she gets a little bit old fashioned when she admits she's fallen in love with him, and she becomes kind of servile. But then, as the film goes on, she gets her kind of fire back, and she turns back into what she was before. Except now she's also in love with him.
If she gets in with the leeches and gets involved, that is a team right there.
Yeah,
that's not
exactly.
That's not a woman swooning. That is a proper heroine, womaning up, getting on board and off board. You know, at the same time.
It seems like it was ahead of its time, and it's especially from a character and a storytelling point of view, it's an impressive film.
I still kind of wanted an African drag queen, though. Or a monarch of some kind. It could have gone that direction. Abby, do you have a thought or a rating to stick on the end here before we wrap it up?
I know, because we didn't really talk about the female empowerment that you just mentioned there. But at the same time, it pretty much just speaks for itself.
It really does.
So I do give it points for that, because that wasn't common for the time either.
Yeah.
No, 1951 is not a time where women should be told to, you know, basically do everything that they've learned is their place. This basically says, don't stick in your place, ladies. Get involved. Woman up. And yeah. It essentially is a post-war patriotic story of British people getting the Nazis. But it's also this, you know, story to encourage women to not just be prissy and that they can get involved as well, which is kind of the attitude that was being bandied about, because women had, you know, helped more than people would have expected during the war. They worked in factories. They did as much as they can. They tried in their ways that society allowed to help more than they would have been expected in years gone by, I think. So it's a very post-war film in that regard as well.
I guess the only other layer that's missing from the film is that class comment that is there, kind of, but it would have made more sense with Charlie being Cockney like he originally was. That would have added another kind of subtext to it about class system in Britain and everything. But, I mean, you know, that's incidental. The film, it doesn't hurt the film particularly to not have that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I suggested the Boat from Apocalypse Now. I tried to say perhaps it's a modern cutting edge speedboat. Any more boat or awkward crowbar again rating?
The Apocalypse Now one was mine. This is backwards Apocalypse Now.
Yes. You can have Apocalypse Now, but I feel like...
Because Apocalypse Now even starts with him talking about his wife's divorce, and this film ends with these two getting married. So it is almost completely the reverse.
I guess
it's
so.
Interesting that I can almost smell another thesis out of you, Jerry.
Yeah. The African Queen, the reverse Apocalypse Now. Anyway, I mean, do we need another boat analogy? We don't really. Who needs boat analogies? It's one of the boats from Tugs, the animated Thomas the Tank style ripoff, where they're all charming little tugboats that have melodrama, romance, and... No, I don't know. It's not really Tugs.
But, you're only saying that.
It's a powerful steamer.
It's the only boat you know.
You just wanted to remind people that Tugs ever existed, like you just did me.
I feel like if Anthony was here, which he sadly could... that makes it sound like he's dead. If Anthony was here, I'm sure me and him would have had a nice chat about Tugs, because he kind of reminded me it existed. That's probably why it was on my mind. But yeah, it's a boat that's good. It's a good boat and a good film, and I think that's enough said, right, guys?
Wow. Yeah.
Now let's strap a torpedo to this podcast and blow up some Nazis.
It's a boat.
slash end the podcast.
It's a boat that's good.
Yes, it's a boat that's good. It's a film that's good. It works very literally. But it is shut up. Jimmy's really clever, and he thought of the thing with Star Wars and the Apocalypse Now, and I just kept mentioning Mills and Boone. What do you want from me? I miss the days of Mills and Boone. They were terrible at the time, but now that we have like a world where 50 Shades of Grey is apparently a thing, I think I want to live in a world with just Mills and Boones. Anywho, bye guys.
Bye.
The end.
Nice.